The podcast network is supported by Neo.org, a social network with a purpose, to transform the world by enabling people to transform themselves. And Tony Kynaston, our first TPN patron. Become a TPN patron or a member of the TPN 500 by visiting tpn.thepodcastnetwork.com.
There's a way, such a better way, today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today there's a better way.
This is Rod Adams, and it's time for Atomic Show number 158 or 59 or something like that. I'll have to correct this during the recording. The correct number is 158. And with me tonight, I have Margaret Harding, Lisa Stiles, and Dan Yearman. And if you all will introduce yourselves in that order and let people hear your voice, we'll get started talking.
Oh, this is Margaret Harding enjoying the deep heat of North Carolina coast and generally trying to stay in where it's dark and cool for the moment.
This is Lisa Stiles. I drove 875 miles north the other day to find it 15 degrees hotter. I've spent 15 years in the nuclear business as an engineer in governmental affairs and also workforce planning. So I have a lot of interests, a wide variety of interests in this business.
And this is Dan Yearman, recently transplanted to the Cleveland-Akron area, and wondering if Mississippi by Lake Erie is what we're going to get with global warming. We've had gully washer thunderstorms here past few days, looking around for the savanna trees and creeping moss on the Lake Erie waterfront blooming tomorrow.
Hey, Dan, when you start getting Spanish moss hanging off the trees, I'll know that it's really warm.
Okay. You've seen one moss, you've seen them all. I mean, what do you want from me?
No, come on.
The bearded stuff that grows off the trees here in the South.
Right, that's right. Spanish moss is that stuff that hangs, and it's just an amazing southern plant. It grows
in the backyard
trees.
Is full of it.
I remember when I was a kid and going to summer camp, we used to occasionally dress up as Moss Man, which is kind of dangerous because it's full of these red bugs.
Yeah,
you've seen those before, I'm sure, Margaret.
Oh yeah, I was just cleaning some of them out of one of my plants the other day.
All right, the nuclear industry is doing a bang up job of supplying lots of electricity this summer. I think that at one point, 97% of the maximum capacity of the nuclear plants in the U.S. was hitting the grid. So that's a pretty impressive record, considering there's a couple of plants that are kind of down for long repairs, like Progress Energy's Crystal River plant. There's also been some interesting political maneuverings going on with regard to the loan guarantee program. Have you guys been keeping up on that?
A little bit, when I haven't been bumming around.
Well, there's two pieces, Rod. There's one is the Secretary Chu asked for $9 billion more for the current program so that he can award loan guarantees to the three other finalists on DOE's shortlist, which are NRG's South Texas project, Calvert Cliffs 3 for Constellation, and SCANA's Vogtle plant. With a T.
And I'll add that Dominion, this is really public knowledge, considers themselves in the running once they selected a technology. When those people in the running were selected, Dominion was in the middle of a competitive bidding process.
There's a second round of loan guarantees, which President Obama has asked for the FY 2011 budget. And that money has been bouncing around, the amount of money that's associated with that in terms of federal insurance. It's not actually funding, it's insurance, has gone up and down. The House came in at one number, the Senate committee cut in half. They still have to go to conference committee. So I think the actual number that will come out in 2011, we're going to have to wait and see what the conference committee does.
Yeah, unfortunately, the last time we had a conference committee decision, I think one of the arms of Congress came in with one number, the other arm came with another number, and the final number was zero.
So Well, that was the stimulus money, and basically the renewable people got to the Obama White House and said it's not going to create near-term jobs. I think things have changed. The president's asked for the loan guarantees in his budget request, so I think the White House is positioned differently this time.
Well, you know, it's one of the things that I think the nuclear industry really needs to get out there and help people understand is you don't have to complete a plant before the jobs appear. As a matter of fact, there's a number of jobs that happen as soon as the financing gets put into place, and a number of jobs that may be lost if the financing keeps wandering off and not getting put into place. A friend of mine is a floor engineer who's been working on the NRG project for about 2 years, and he has just reported via Twitter that he's no longer being paid until somebody makes a decision on loan guarantees.
That's right. NRG laid off about reportedly laid off about half of the engineering staff at STP from Fluor because they're waiting to see whether they get this or not. That seems like an odd decision because they're pretty much lined up to get it. There must be something else going on.
Well, even if they're lined up to get it, if the money doesn't show up, you know, the longer you delay, I mean, they've finished everything they can finish that the energy is willing to pay for until they know they can go forward. And so if you just keep paying people day after day after day, all you're doing is losing money.
Right, well, that's, and that's not reimbursable.
Well, that's true. That's true. We can talk about jobs showing up. If you look at the life cycle of reactor construction project, people say, well, there's 3,000 jobs, there's 5,000 jobs. You don't have all 5,000 people on the job site at once. First of all, I think a realistic picture is that you have different kinds of skill mixes at different times on the job site. And that there's a core period of about 3 or 4 years when you have peak employment at the job site. And then again, the skill mix will change as the reactor gets closer to first fuel load and to operations.
Absolutely. There's if you look at Southern's plans, I think that they're fairly public on when they expect what type of jobs during the construction, how many and what types of skills are needed. But it's still a huge boon to local economy, especially now when we're looking at consumer spending. Consumers aren't as confident as they were. You know, when you've got a whole bunch of people on a construction site need places to sleep and places to eat and everything else in between. It will be a real boon for the local economy of these areas where we're going forward, like at Southern.
Yeah, there's some interesting political alignments happening. I guess Chet Edwards is a representative from Texas, and he's in a battle for re-election. He's one of the country's most endangered Democrats, but he didn't hesitate to use his clout to make sure that Comanche Peak, which is, I think, not first, but is like in the next round, would have access to some funding. So he's on the House Appropriations Committee. I believe he's also the chairman of the House Appropriations Committee, and he made sure that the House put $25 billion in for loan guarantees.
Well, that's kind of a no-brainer for him, actually, because Comanche Peak was the fifth runner-up on the short list.
Exactly.
His
opponent, a Republican, believes that it's a waste of money to provide loan guarantees to nuclear projects, although it doesn't cost the federal taxpayers anything. The only reason it has to be put in the budget is because they have to allow for a certain amount of default insurance.
Right.
Right. Yeah, I think a lot of people don't understand how that works, that the utilities pay the risk premium for, like, mortgage insurance for that. They also pay the administrative costs that the government incurs for running the program. And actually been, it hasn't hit the news too much, but it has been a bit of contention about how much, you know, what are the terms of the contract of the loan guarantees? Is there, how much of risk premium do people, do the utilities have to pay, and how is that calculated? Other stipulations, I forgot the name of the legislation, somebody else might know it, but when the government issues grants, particular kind of grants, there's a requirement when it's available to use union labor. Now, this isn't a grant, it's a loan guarantee, but there's been talk that the federal government would require all union labor on the construction sites. And that could be a big obstacle for some utilities in some states.
Now, I don't think the government actually requires union labor.
No, that's not it. That's not a
prevailing wage.
That's not in the terms and conditions for loan guarantees, Lisa.
It would be easy for them to add that.
Right, it'd be easy for them to add it, but it's not in the actual. When Southern signed a conditional commitment for their loan guarantees, that was not in there.
Right,
to my knowledge.
I know that, but it has been. It has been under discussion. Talking with the Nuclear Energy Institute and other people working on these things in different states, it has been under consideration that would be a requirement.
Building trades unions are pushing that because, as a matter of fact, that was behind some press releases they put out earlier this year about the U.S. sending its technology to China and sending jobs with it. I mean, they're grousing about this for a while. But getting back to your first point.
And well, they should, because the U.S. taxpayers paid for the development of a lot of that technology.
Okay. Getting back to Lisa's first point, I'll come back to your point in a minute. On the fee, Southern actually delayed signing their conditional commitment because they wanted to come to terms with the Department of Energy on what their premium would be. The thing that we're waiting to see is, I think, Constellation, if they are offered a loan guarantee, what their premium will be, because they've been very vocal about the need for the premium to be low as possible. See how that works out. On the other hand, Areva came to terms very quickly with the Department of Energy on the conditional commitment for the Eagle Rock and Richmond facility. I think in part, this is just me speculating, I don't have anything from Areva to tell me this is true or not, that they want to lock up that commitment so that no one else could show up and say, well, you know, we have a better plan here. You know, we don't think you should give that to Areva. So once that paperwork is locked up, it makes it that much more difficult for a competitor to undo it.
Well, especially with Areva being French-owned, if a U.S. company came in and said, hey, we want the money, you could see a competitive issue there.
Well, I think Areva's counter to that, having talked to the people somewhat extensively about this, and Rod, you probably had some more insights from your trip to France with the Areva people. All of the construction jobs in Idaho are going to be American jobs. The steel is going to come from American plants. In fact, the only thing that's going to come from overseas are the centrifuges, which come from a European company.
That's true. And based on what I saw, there's a tremendous amount of construction work associated with building an enrichment facility. I watched the George Bessie II enrichment facility under construction, and it's a pretty impressive sight to see the rows and rows of foundations for the centrifuges, because there will be a lot of them. Now, another thing that I also, just as an aside, the replacement of George Bessie 1, which is a gas diffusion plant, with George Bessie 2, which is a centrifuge plant, is one of the most amazing energy conservation stories that you can imagine. They're going to go from consuming 2,700 megawatts to consuming 50 megawatts.
Wow.
Fantastic.
With the same amount of SWU's output. separative work units. That's pretty impressive. That, you know, that should make even Amory Lovins happy.
Yeah.
So the I happen to believe that the nuclear industry has a strong advocate and a strong partner with the organized unions. Much of the labor associated with nuclear energy is going to be union anyway because of the trades that are involved. You don't get electricians that aren't members of a union, for example. And the unions have been out there really pushing to get nuclear plants under construction. So I'm not sure that that's a battle that I'd want the industry to start fighting.
Sure, I think you're right. Unions have certainly been some of the most vocally favorable towards nuclear, done a lot of work in Washington to talk about the jobs the good solid jobs that they're talking about that aren't to pay a livable wage and better.
And again, you mentioned that the Constellation is more aggressive about talking about keeping the cost down. I wonder if that's because Constellation is a merchant generator, where Southern Company is a utility generator and can simply pass the cost of whatever they pay for loan guarantees to their rate base.
Well, Construction While in Progress, or CWIP, which is what Southern has in Georgia, is not a free pass for rate increases. They still have to go back into the regulatory agency in the state of Georgia that governs rate increases and make their case. And consumer groups and ratepayers have just as much access to interventions for every one of those rate increases as they would for anything else. So the utility has its work cut out for it. In fact, in conversation with SCANA folks in the summer of 2010, was 2009 rather, beg your pardon, told me that these rate increases for CWIP are probably the most hair-raising of their experiences, because they have to explain to the public why a rate increase now will result in lower electricity bills 6 to 10 years from now. The public just cannot grasp the concept paying more now and paying less later.
That's because Americans have forgotten the fact that you have to they believed you can just keep borrowing money and forget they have to pay interest on that money.
And they believe that electricity just is what comes out at the switch, that they don't understand how electricity is generated and the kind of production facilities it requires.
Yeah, Dan, my point was not about the CWIP. Eventually, Southern can recover whatever costs they spend when the plant is operating by rolling it into the rate base for anything that's considered to be a prudent expense. And as far as I know, in the prudency hearings, no government-mandated cost was ever considered to be imprudent.
Well, I think we have an issue here. I want to come back to your prior comment about America's views of money. There's an air of unreality in our political debate, and it's longstanding. It's an irrational element, and I'm increasingly coming to believe that the irrational elements of American politics are becoming more and more pervasive. I'll give you an example from Idaho from a few years back. A woman named Helen Chenoweth was elected to 3 terms from the 2nd Congressional District, which is Boise in the north to the Panhandle. And during this time, there was an ongoing debate about whether to remove 4 dams in order to save endangered salmon. The dams are very important for electricity generation in the Pacific Northwest, especially for irrigated agriculture, which use electricity to run pumps. Helen was an arch conservative who opposed the Endangered Species Act, and her famous comment was, "I don't understand why people think salmon are endangered. I can go to the supermarket anytime I want and buy a can of it."
That's kind of rational, I think.
Oh dear.
That's like my check. What do you mean I don't have any money? I still have checks in my check.
I have still checks. Yeah, my plastic still works.
Yeah. All right, so go ahead.
So my point is that the Republican in Texas is probably opposed to Comanche Peak solely for the reason because his Democratic opponent is for it.
Or because his friends who give him money from the oil and gas industry are opposed to it as well.
Well, also Rick Perry, the governor down there, is pretty much forced to be reckoned with. He's pretty conservative too, and I think there's you know, it's still a Republican stronghold. Obama did not carry Texas in 2008, and he doesn't do well according to press reports in Texas public opinion surveys. Democrat in Texas is got an uphill battle. Whether nuclear loan guarantees, Glen Rose and Fort Worth area can help them, we'll have to see.
I think it's interesting that you have a Democrat who is strongly supportive of expanding nuclear energy and a Republican who's fighting the expansion of nuclear energy when a lot of folks always...
It's usually the other way around.
I don't believe it's the other way around anymore, and I think that people have been painting it that way for a long time, even though it's not really the case. I mean, heck, we've had at least 20 years worth of Republican administrations that didn't build a single nuclear power plant in the U.S. So, all right, on to the South Koreans' request to recycle used fuel. The South Koreans' agreement with the U.S. expires in 2012, and they're not happy about the fact that right now the U.S. won't let them recycle, but the U.S. also will not take back any used fuel from them.
Well, sooner or later, I think the South Koreans and the U.S. are going to have to come to terms on this. It has to do with North Korea more than anything else. And the reason they're going to have to come to terms with this is because the South Koreans have a $20 billion contract with the United Arab Emirates. And sooner or later, those reactors supplied by South Korea are going to change out their fuel. Now, if South Korea inks a deal with Areva to supply the fuel, then the fuel will go back to France. But South Korea is also substantially increasing its own reactor fleet, and so they do have a problem. The issue has been, I think, framed as a non-proliferation issue because it would, quote, raise tensions on the peninsula and, quote, send the wrong message to North Korea. The North Koreans, you know, talk about the irrational in politics. They're the ultimate example of that. So I don't understand why you think that being rational about what signals you send to them are going to make any difference.
That's a good point.
Very good point.
They'll ignore whatever signals they get and do whatever they want to do anyway.
Right.
But my point is that the South Korea is a good ally. They have shown to be responsible with regard to nuclear energy, and there is really no risk of anyone trying to use reactor-grade plutonium to build a weapon. So why not recycle?
Well, if I was a South Koreans, I'd be seriously annoyed with the U.S. position because we've told the Indians they can go ahead and reprocess their fuel. Now, India was a... quote-unquote pariah in the nuclear fuel business for 30 years until the nuclear suppliers group said, okay, you can buy fuel again because you're not going to make bombs. Okay, we'll see how that goes. But the point is that we're inconsistent. And the South Koreans are saying, look, we sell you cars, we sell you electronics, you know, we're really a very strong ally. The Indians will not pass, you know, a liability bill to allow U.S. reactors to do business in India, but you give them the ability to reprocess fuel. But us, who are your steadfast friends, you know, you basically have stubbed your toe on this issue with us.
Right, and the South Koreans are also signatories of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which binds them to not develop nuclear weapons, but allows them access to all phases of the nuclear fuel cycle.
It's definitely an inconsistent policy, and I think that's where our Asian friends get a little fed up.
There's a very good review of this issue, by the way, in the New York Times on July 13th. The title of the article is U.S. Wary of South Korea's Plan to Reuse Nuclear Fuel. And it quotes the usual non-proliferation sources. I think, Rod, you had a blog post this week that I thought was very helpful. Maybe we ought to talk about it for a minute, because you kind of stepped people through the source of Jimmy Carter's decision and so forth. And just for our listeners, maybe you could give us a brief summary of that, and then we can chat about that some more.
Sure. There's been an argument or position stated for a long time, dating back to at least 1975, 76, 77 time frame, that says that reactor-grade plutonium is inherently a nuclear weapons proliferation risk, and that the U.S. policy established by Jimmy Carter was that we would no longer recycle, use nuclear fuel because we wanted to set an example for the rest of the world. And the basis of that argument, or at least the technical basis, was a statement by Jimmy Carter that declassified the existence of a test that was conducted at the Nevada test site in 1962. Now, Jimmy Carter didn't release any additional details of the test at the time, and simply stated that it was done with reactor-grade plutonium, proving beyond a shadow of a doubt that it was possible to build a weapon from that material. And what I wrote about in my blog post was there was an additional release of information during the 1990s by Secretary of Energy Hazel O'Leary that gave a few additional details about the source of the plutonium. And the source of the plutonium was from Great Britain. If you go back and you have access to all of the information we have today about what kind of reactors were available in Great Britain in 1962 that could possibly have supplied plutonium, there was only one commercial nuclear power plant operating. It was a Magnox facility at Berkeley Station, which had only just started up in about June of 1962. So if plutonium from the Berkeley station was used, it had to have been very lightly irradiated, because in order to take it out of the reactor, bring it to the U.S., form it into some sort of explosive, and explode it before the end of 1962, there's no way it could have had very much time in a reactor. So the bottom line was the isotopics of that plutonium could not have been much different than what we call weapons-grade plutonium, and certainly was not plutonium that was exposed in a commercial nuclear reactor and developed a burn-up of 30 to 50 megawatt days per ton.
And you might want to explain why that makes a difference, Rod.
You're the nuclear engineer here. I'm just an English major.
You're doing a great job, though.
Get off it, Rod.
All right. The isotopics are important because what bomb manufacturers had determined way long ago was that when plutonium gets exposed or gets created by exposing uranium-238 to neutron flux in a reactor, it develops a very complex mix of isotopes, some of which are fairly controllable and fairly predictable, and others of which undergo spontaneous fission and release neutrons at whatever time they feel like releasing neutrons. The part of plutonium that is useful in a bomb is plutonium-239. But if you operate in a reactor for a long period of time, you get plutonium-238, you get plutonium-240, you get plutonium-241, all of which cannot be separated without isotope separation. That's even more difficult than separating uranium-235 from uranium-238.
You're basically making it more difficult to get the kind of chain reaction you want out of a bomb when you are using fuel that's been irradiated for a long time in a commercial reactor.
Right, and already, even the very incredibly talented technical team available at Los Alamos in 1945 figured out that plutonium, even if it was pure reactor grade stuff, had to have a very special bomb design that required setting off a whole bunch of conventional explosives formed in a sphere around another set of plutonium, and they had to be incredibly carefully timed, shaped, machined, and all kinds of stuff. You try to do that with reactor-grade plutonium, the bottom line is that you just can't do it. And nobody's ever done it. Let's put it that way. Nobody's ever done it. Is it impossible? Well, I guess if you give enough chimpanzees typewriters, you could maybe write a Shakespearean sonnet, but I don't think so.
I thought you explained that extremely well, Rod. So you don't need any nuclear engineering degree to be able to explain those types of concepts.
So anyway, I think it's a wrong wrong policy to assert that used nuclear fuel from a commercially operated light water reactor is remotely usable as a weapon. So preventing it from being recycled because you're afraid of weapons proliferation is really either you're technically incompetent, you're technically misinformed, or you're lying out your so that you can slow down the development of nuclear weapons. I mean, nuclear power. So you can slow down the development of nuclear power. Okay, it's not about weapons.
When I talk to people, trying to explain how remote is remote for using commercial used nuclear fuels for plutonium for weapons. But so when you say remote, a lot of people don't want to know exactly, and that's hard. But I will tell them that the most difficult way to get weapons grade material is to build a light water reactor or the kind of reactors that we have here in the U.S. To get the material. There are much easier, cheaper options such as centrifuge technology. And that's when I start to explain to people why we worry about other nations when they're looking at enrichment, without getting into the politics of who should and who shouldn't. But certainly it's easy to get the message to people that it just doesn't make practical sense if somebody's trying to covertly get weapons material, building a reactor for to generate electricity such as the way we do it here in the U.S. just doesn't make any sense.
Well, and people need to understand that the reactors that we operate here in the U.S., the light water reactors, are, as everybody should know, operate at very high temperatures and under a great deal of pressure. The pressure vessels that we have to keep all that stuff from leaking are not only bolted shut with some of the biggest bolts you've ever seen in your life, and many of them, they're also welded shut. And the control rods are welded on. The only way you can open those up to get to the fuel is an industrial process to cut those seal welds. And that's a process that, we've gotten so we're pretty good at it. But even the very best takes, best is 20 days or something of really heavy industrial work to move the fuel rods out of the reactor core. After you've cooled down the reactor, so.
And frankly, you can't carry them. The bundles are really heavy.
Well, like
450 pounds or so.
Say 500 pounds. Is that okay? Good.
It depends. And the BWR is the lighter of the two, and it's about 450 pounds fully loaded.
That's a 9x9.
A 10x10. It doesn't matter. It's about 180 kilograms of uranium, give or take. And then you add all the metal in there and convert. You get about 450, 500 pounds, something around like that.
Right, and you can handle it safely under 20 feet of water, but if you try to be close
to it. Exactly. You can't carry it. My comment is usually, if I were a terrorist and I wanted to do something, I'd steal cobalt-60 from medical devices and build a dirty bomb first.
Well, I've got an article about dirty bombs, because even that doesn't scare me, because if...
No, me either, but... My point is
I'd be
that,
much more scared about being close to the bomb, regardless of what's wrapped around it.
Right.
I mean, the easiest way, I think that the low-tech way, North Korea has shown the low-tech way to build a bomb, and that is You stack up a bunch of natural uranium with a bunch of pure graphite, and you operate it the same way that the production reactors were operated to move the fuel slugs out quickly, and you give yourself enough time, you can build enough material. And it doesn't take that much technology to do that. However, anyway, I just think that it's bad policy to upset an ally. It's bad policy to slow down the development of nuclear energy in places that really need it. And South Korea, people have to remember, not only doesn't have its own oil, but it can't buy natural gas because there's this thing called North Korea between it and any natural gas supplies.
I think the other thing to talk about in terms of non-proliferation incidents, we have to go back to a serious incident with North Korea in which the Israelis bombed a site inside of Syria two and a half years ago, I think it was September 2007, in which it was turned out that the Syrians simply leveled the site, removed absolutely everything from it. And there's been a lot of speculation that that was a graphite reactor and that the North Koreans had delivered everything that Syria needed in order to start manufacturing weapons, plutonium for a nuclear weapon. And the Israelis simply pasted it. Now, I'm not saying that this means the Israelis should run off and bomb Iran. That's a separate issue. But if you want to look at who's been proliferating weapons, it's not South Korea. It's North Korea.
Yep. All right. So also staying in excuse me, in Asia, China has started up another type of reactor. They started up a sodium-cooled fast reactor that will give them some more technical understanding, and I believe they already have contracts to purchase a couple of Russian fast reactors.
That's right. China announced a three-part deal in April of this year to purchase from the Russians two BN-800 reactors. The Russians have been developing these for some time. And there's a bilateral agreement with France, Electricité de France, to provide some expertise to help build them. The Russians are the only country that is seriously pursuing fast reactors as a commercial entity for export, which they are clearly doing with the Chinese. China, this is not new news. China announced that they were pursuing this back in October of 2009. But the fact is that one of their test reactors was reported by World Nuclear News on July 22nd that China had achieved criticality of its first neutron reactor. This is the Chinese experimental fast reactor, which has a thermal capacity of 60 megawatts and reportedly produces 20 megawatts of electrical power. It was developed by the China Institute of Atomic Energy, and as Rod pointed out, it is the first sodium-cooled fast reactor in China. So that's pretty interesting. The China was at one time working on indigenous designs of its own for a 600-megawatt reactor, but they've now reportedly set these aside in favor of simply buying the technology directly from the Russians.
And why not? That's what China does best. Buys other people's technology, then reverse engineers it.
Well, I think there's a couple of estimates about how long it will take the Chinese to bring these reactors to fruition. And the Chinese have been very public about their commitment to raise their nuclear generating capacity from their current 9 gigawatts, which is basically the nuclear output of Sweden, to put that in perspective, to 70 gigawatts, which would be an eight-fold increase over the next couple of decades. Beyond right. that, there are a whole series of other speculative estimates about how much they're really going to build. But for the present time, all of those reactors are expected to be light water reactor designs. And for reference purposes, I'll say similar to the Westinghouse AP1000. Deal with the Russians suggests that beyond 2020, some of those reactors could be fast reactors. Now, China, for those of you who follow the uranium mining business as I do, has been buying uranium at a fierce pace. They just inked a deal to take make a major buy of uranium from Cameco in Canada, buying between a quarter and a half of their output over the next 5 to 10 years. They are also scouring the globe for uranium because they have no significant domestic uranium mining producing uranium. Obviously, the fast reactors give them the opportunity to get more bang from the buck from the uranium that they have or which they expect to have.
And actually, China does also have a high-temperature gas reactor program going. They've got two HTR, two HTR PMs, which are 250 megawatts thermal, under construction right now. Those are follow-up to the HTR 10. I've got a video in which a news crew from Australia Broadcasting Corporation, the Catalyst program, went to China and visited the HTR 10. And there's a section in that video when there's a smiling, but I think rather evil, Chinese scientist who's basically telling this, the Australians this. He said, you know, nuclear energy is very, very hard, and we don't think that you should worry yourself about developing nuclear energy. Just sell us your uranium, and we'll take care of it for you.
Oh, that's scary.
It is. It's a very, like I say, he's a smiling guy, and he's bouncing one of the pebbles from the HTR-10 in his hand, and he says, just sell us your uranium. Don't bother developing your own nuclear energy capability. So, yes, the Chinese are out there making good deals, buying a lot of uranium at $41 a pound or whatever the current price is. Now, are they buying a lot from Kazakhstan, Dan?
No, not particularly. The Chinese have bought a lot of their uranium from they have deals in Kazakhstan, but the big recent buys are Australia and most significantly recently announced from Canada. So they're scouring the globe for uranium, and there's a competition for uranium 20 years from now will start to look like competition for oil today. Chinese know this, and that's why they're doing the fast reactors.
Well, I think that that's
even more important.
I think that's not exactly true unless we continue to shoot ourselves in the foot and refuse to recycle uranium. Because we've got an awful lot of uranium above ground already that could be used. We just need to start implementing the technology we know works to use that uranium well.
Okay, well, coming back to high-temperature gas-cooled reactors, which are, after all, fast reactors because there's no water to moderate the neutrons, the Chinese launched what we would call a pebble bed reactor at Shandong in October of 2008. This is their commercial implementation, which is expected to produce about 200 megawatts for electricity. They expect to have it operating commercially. Don't have my notes here. Don't tell me when. But this is very exciting for them because they have moved forward with this technology, leaving behind two other competitors, one of which is the United States. Now, let's just talk about pebble beds for a minute because I think it's kind of instructive. Jared, as you point out on your blog and also I've noted on mine, the South African pebble bed modular reactor project has collapsed, and they're now in the process of shutting it down, primarily because there was no customer for the technology and because the costs in South Africa became unsustainable. The country is broke. The World Bank is not going to give them a loan. They can't get money from other investors. And the only way they're going to build new nuclear power plants in South Africa is as merchants, which is that the people who build them, you know, build them as investments and then run them, and the South Africans buy the electricity from them. They're not going to be turnkey operations. They're going to be in investor-owned properties. It's a lot more risky, but might be the only way they can do it. In the United States, we have the next generation nuclear plant the Department of Energy released $40 million for design studies to two consortiums, one led by Westinghouse, the other led by General Atomics. Those conceptual design reports are due this fall to the Department of Energy. But the question becomes, who's going to pay for the first version of a high-temperature gas-cooled reactor in the United States? And when? Best estimates are that it would be 2020 or later before the engineering and licensing work was nearing completion, that customers could start seriously thinking about whether it was commercially viable to try and build one. By the time that happens, the Chinese will be exporting these things.
Yeah, I had a meeting with DOE back in 2006, I believe, trying to encourage them to move their timeline up a little bit. Even then, they were looking at 2021 before they'd finished the engineering design work. And I try to keep telling them that the problem is they're biting off too big a task by wanting to go to very high temperatures, and instead of using what's already been proven at 800 to 900 degrees Celsius, they were trying to make fuel that was capable of going to 1050 Celsius.
Well, this is a battle.
It's a science project. It's a project that really is about keeping a bunch of scientists at INL employed, and has nothing to do with actually making power. The Chinese, on the other hand, have said, we're going to go, they copied the German AVR, which is their HTR-10, which is what I was talking about before. They are now developing or building the two reactor, one turbine plant that limits the reactor power to about 250 megawatts thermal. Two 250 megawatt thermal reactors feeding one 200 megawatt electric steam turbine. Okay, so that's almost identical to what has already been done in Germany before. The 250 megawatt thermal limit for a reactor is well known within the PBMR or the pebble bed or graphite moderated high temperature reactor community to be the temperature at which you can prove passive safety.
What's the temperature again?
The thermal limit is about 250 megawatts thermal. Once you get beyond that, you need to have forced cooling to provide safety. That thermal limit, anything below that, you can get passive safety.
That's very interesting because being from Idaho and having worked at the INL for 20 years until July of 2009, I'm somewhat familiar with the NGMP project. Two comments, Rod, in response to your characterization. I think it's a little bit harsh to call it a science sandbox. People there are pretty dedicated to what they're doing, and they have been tasked by the Department of Energy to look at the issue of very high temperature material studies. That said, I have had some very serious disagreements in a civil manner with several people who are in senior positions on that program over the years. And off the record, they have told me that they are committed to, which confirms your issue, the higher temperatures. And in fact, I did a blog post earlier this year suggesting that the output from a high-temperature gas-cooled reactor of around 400 to 500 degrees C might be ideal for industrial process heat, and they blew a fuse over that. The other thing I would mention is that NGMP has always been characterized publicly as having significantly higher thermal output than your 250 megawatts. I think they've talked as much as, just significantly higher. Numbers aren't important. So there's a lot of issues, I think, that are yet to be resolved on that. Technically, I'm not going to dive into it because I don't think it takes us down a different rabbit hole. I wonder if we could talk, though, about the likelihood of success of other small reactors. I know, Rod, you attended a small reactor conference, posted a couple of things on that. What's your view there? Do you think we're going to see some small reactors achieve commercial success?
Yes. Oh, you want details?
We actually talked about this at length on the last.
Yeah,
this is like the old joke about the woman who sat next to Warren G. Harding and said, "I bet I can get more two words out of you," and she said, "You lose."
No, I did talk a lot about small reactors on my last podcast. I would like to report, though, that I have visited one of the engineering facilities that is completely dedicated to building an evolutionary light water reactor, smaller than most people consider to be commercially viable. It's a 125 megawatt generation M-Power. The facility is impressive. They rented about, at least 12,000 square feet. They've got 100 engineers and very nice brand new offices and cubicles. Got great support. They're bringing on Bechtel as a partner. And I believe it's a real deal, and they've got a good team with a good timeline.
I'm looking for a new job. What do you think?
Well, I can't say why I was down there.
Oh, okay.
Nice.
Okay. So, yeah, I believe that I've talked to the guy from Kiewit Construction who did the cost analysis estimate for NuScale. It just happens that he was my company commander when I was a plebe at the Naval Academy. He's a retired Navy captain, a lot of facility experience, but he's also a former submarine commanding officer. So he's a real deal. He's a straightforward, honest guy, and he told me that he'll back what he said, which is about $4,000 per kilowatt capacity if you buy a 12-pack, and about $4,400 dollars per kilowatt capacity if you buy a six pack. So I believe that those are reasonably competitive and offer a financing package that the big guys can't match, because it's much simpler to buy a 540 megawatt plant that you can buy in 12 different pieces, or a 500 megawatt plant you can buy in four pieces, than buying it all at once.
Well, I think this is the thing that really is exciting about small reactors. Although the climate bill has apparently tanked prior to the 2010 elections, I think we're going to see a climate bill and carbon taxes in the country eventually. And if I'm a small utility, especially a municipal utility, which has got its apron strings tied to a major coal-fired utility and can't get its power from anywhere else, what I'm thinking about is how do I possibly pass through rate increases that will include those taxes to my rate base without being tarred and feathered by them, or by having independent power producers come in, especially from unregulated, deregulated state, and steal my rate base, because they can find, maybe have nuclear power and can, you know, don't have carbon taxes associated with it. So what I'm thinking is, if I'm a small utility like that, I can't bet the ranch on a 1,000 megawatt plant, but I could certainly bet by 125 megawatts of power that doesn't have carbon taxes on it. And the first reactor pays for the second. I mean, this is very clear that once you have a revenue stream going and you've successfully built one and implemented, investors will flock to your door because they figure you can do it again, especially if the demand is there, or if you can wheel the power to other customers.
And especially if the second unit is identical to the first one and comes out of the same factory.
Exactly. So I think that this is what it does. The reason is they call it a game changer. This was Bechtel's characterization at the press conference that you attended. By the way, I saw you in the video of that press conference. So 15 minutes of fame there for you, Ron. I think the game-changing nature is it expands the market for nuclear energy in the U.S. in ways that heretofore were simply impossible, because it now creates a whole new class of customers for nuclear energy.
And that's one thing I'd like to point out on the advocacy side. That's where it's important for people to get involved when we start really seriously debating energy policy legislation, whether it's carbon tax or cap and trade or whatever it's going to be, to make sure nuclear is treated fairly and equitably compared to other energy technologies. And then the other thing is the licensing structure we have with the NRC that's built upon the large, 1,000 megawatt or more reactors isn't necessarily appropriate, whether it's with how it's reviewed or how much it costs to review the application. And that's where sometimes I anticipate that advocates may need to get involved to talk about the legislation and then also the regulatory changes that are needed.
I'd like to just second that and advise people to get into the Library of Congress Thomas legislative system and search on small reactors. There's a couple of pieces of legislation now pending that would, number one, change the cost reimbursement rule at the NRC for small reactors, provide money to the Department of Energy to help advance the technology and so forth. So there are people are paying attention in Congress. To this issue, and I know that these small reactor companies themselves have DC representation and are pushing these issues as well.
Yep, there's a lot of game-changing things going on. The Empower Generation Empower team announced that they had, I think, 12. Utilities, some of which are small co-ops that are associated. But another thing I wanted to mention, even without carbon taxes, Exelon showed a slide during their recent earnings call that showed all of the regulation changes that are occurring for that are related to things like the interstate transport rule, the tightening of SO2 regulations, a tightening of fly ash regulations, a whole bunch of other things that are already coming down the pike that are going to raise the cost of using coal in a plant that doesn't have scrubbers and atmosphere controls and all that other stuff. So even without trying to capture the carbon dioxide or do something to charge for that, the cost of burning coal, particularly in older non-compliant plants, is going to go up.
Yeah, I just want to give it a practical. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think that's something that is a little easier to communicate to the public almost than carbon, as far as it's more immediate to the health and welfare to them. So, certainly, I'm not going to get into debate here about what the effect of anthropogenic carbon, if man's causing global warming or not. But beyond that, we should be looking at immediate effects of the pollutants that are spewed into the air and burning fossil fuels. And that's something that that at least is more immediate. I know I have asthma, and there are certain days in certain cities where breathing outside is not an easy thing, and that's when we talk about the sulfur dioxides and the nitrous oxides and the other pollutants that are already regulated. And like Rob said, those regulations are being tightened.
Well, let's look at the utilities that already have coal plants and nuclear plants. Good case in point is one of the utilities that actually spoke at that B&W Bechtel conference, and that's First Energy. I did a follow-up call with the company and my blog coverage of that, and what they told me is that they have put money into funding the design work, and they are interested in exploring being an early customer for small reactors. And I'm sure that one of the reasons they're looking at that is, gee, we've got all these coal plants, are they still going to be affordable if carbon taxes and other regulations show up? And when they reach the end of their useful life, just what are we going to replace them with?
Well, and that's actually a point I've used as well. When you get into the debates is not only the carbon of the effect of coal on the atmosphere, but the fly ash and the mountain topping. And to talk about the just total package of coal and its costs, my son was home over the weekend and we were talking about it, and he said the main thing that's got to happen is that coal has to start paying its way, like nuclear has been its entire industry life. Pay for the front end as well as the back end.
Yeah, and if you start doing that, the notion of cheap coal starts to disappear.
Because
the only reason it's cheap is because it's cheap, like, you know, going and buying an unfinished piece of furniture is cheap because it ain't finished yet. There's a lot of work left to do to make it a useful piece of furniture. And that's kind of the way coal has been getting off with only doing part of the task, getting it out of the ground and moving it to the plant. Haven't really worried about, you know, what do you do with these fly-ash pools when you decommission a coal-fired power plant? You know, there's an awful lot of mess that's left behind.
That's right.
So, hey, folks, I enjoyed talking with you tonight, but I think we're running over an hour now, so we're right up to an hour.
Time flies when you're having fun, Rod.
I know it does, but I don't want to, you know, put people to sleep. So I try to limit, you know, to about an hour or so. And, you know, I'm imposing on your time, and, you know, I don't want to double your salary, so. Okay, I'm sorry. Hey, I did want to mention one more thing, though, before I take off. And I haven't yet worked out all the details with the guy who's doing the fundraising, but here's a quick story. There were two high school students who are members of a debate club who their topic that they chose for their competitive debates this year was defending nuclear energy. And in doing their research for their debates, they talked to folks like Ted Rockwell and Len Koch and a few other real pioneers in the business and got really well prepared. And in the national competitions, they ended up, I think, coming in about 14th or 15th place, which is pretty darn impressive if you ever have seen how many teams get involved in something like that. And one of the guys, John Shanahan, who was helping them meet the right people and talk to the right folks, I guess he knows the debaters, has suggested to them that they make a video of their experience and sit down and interview the nuclear pioneers face-to-face that they talk to, you know, via email and over the phone, and kind of document their experience. And basically, I'm telling you that we're going to do a little bit of fundraising to try to make this thing happen while these two students still have some free time here in August.
So. Well, why don't we put in the next nuclear carnival? You know, it gets on all the blog sites, and we could get it out there that way.
That's a good idea.
I'll also get a hold of a couple of professors I know. There's a Texas A&M does a video thing in their spring coursework. And maybe I can get some technical help for him.
Okay. That would be good. So I'll probably pass out the information. Once I asked John if he had a one-pager that could explain exactly what the video is going to be like and what kind of money they need, and then try to help him reach the right folks, because it sounds like a fascinating project to me. And besides, it'll give me something to decorate my website with.
There you go.
All right. You guys have a great week. Hopefully we'll get together again soon.
Sounds good.
Thanks a lot, Rod.
Thanks.
All right, Rod. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
There's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way. Such a better way today, today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. The way is the Adams way.
You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.